Block by Block, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Iraqi forces are fighting pitched battles against ISIS on the streets of Mosul, and this BBC correspondent is there.
We're just moving forward and still coming under fire.
A report from the front lines. Also, during World War II, a group of Jewish prisoners wanted to escape their Nazi captors.
So they hatched a plan, and they decided that they would dig a tunnel and try to escape,
using only their hands and spoons. Plus, a small-town Newfoundland mayor on what it's like to see a giant iceberg float by just offshore.
You get two, say, three houses in a row, that shows you about what the size of it is, right?
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We begin today with news from the front lines of the fight against ISIS. The U.S. has a lot at stake in this. Washington is backing local forces that are battling ISIS on the ground in Iraq and Syria. A $300 million sale of U.S. military equipment to Iraq was just announced today. And American troops are involved in either support or special ops in both countries. Right now, the biggest single battle against the so-called Islamic State is in Mosul, in northern Iraq. The Iraqi army, with American support, has been trying to take the city back from ISIS for months now. It's grinding, street-by-street combat, as my BBC colleague Jonathan Beale witnessed when he went in the city with Iraqi troops.
The first wave of troops of Iraqi security forces in what will be the first major assault by them in Mosul for the past few weeks is now moving into position and getting ready for that attack. And just overhead, you can hear the sound of a drone. Hopefully one of the coalitions, not one of ISIS. The first injury's just come back from the front line. Looks like he's walking wounded. Being treated now. We're just moving forward and still coming under fire. We're under cover. It was just before daybreak, and people around here will be waking up to the sound not just of gunfire but the call to prayer. Strange combination. Hellfire going on. That was the sound of an airstrike.
He said on the radio, this is Lieutenant Muntadhar. He said, please send us support and Humvee. We are wounded. And there's many soldiers also wounded with me inside. We need to take us out from that location.
This battle's been raging now for 2 hours. And there's still, as you can hear, fierce resistance from IS. And it's just a matter of streets that they've made to cross. Just been told to get inside because they spotted an IS drone in the sky over the street. We've been here for 4 hours in the same house. We arrived under the cover of darkness, and it is now daylight, and the fighting is still fierce. We left with the fight still raging in the same Humvee we arrived in. The seats now bloodied, ferrying the injured and dying. This was just one battle for one street. With most of the old city of Mosul still in IS control, victory feels like a long way off.
The BBC's Jonathan Beale reporting on the intense street-by-street fighting underway right now in western Mosul. The world's Rich Hall has recently returned from northern Iraq. Rich, do we have any idea overall how many civilians are currently trapped in West Mosul and what their situation's like?
So the UN estimates around 750 to 800,000 in West Mosul, in the western section of the city. Now, in the old city, which is the most densely populated part of the city, there are around 400,000 people. These civilians are trapped. They are trapped in between the fighting between ISIS and the Iraqi forces. So not only do they have to contend with the fighting that's going on all around them, they're also in a state of siege almost. Because the Iraqi forces have surrounded this part of the city, no fuel, no food, no supplies are getting in at all. There's also been reports that running water is running out and electricity is scarce. So it really is just a hellish situation now in western Mosul.
Are any groups able to get in to provide aid?
None at all. The Iraqi army is advancing in the old city as we speak. But it's a really tough fight. There are booby traps on every corner. There are ISIS snipers on every building. It's just impossible for anyone to get in or out. The few that are escaping are running through a maze of dangers, really, to get out.
I know you've spoken to some of the people who fled western Mosul. What did they tell you about what it's like being in there?
That's right. I managed to speak to some people who had fled west Mosul and who were recovering in a hospital in Erbil in northern Iraq. And the picture they paint is just utterly horrifying. They were being shot at as they fled by ISIS, and they were also, many of them were injured by U.S. airstrikes. And the U.S. is supporting the Iraqi army in the offensive to retake western Mosul. And so there is just danger on every corner.
Are there many American troops there aiding the Iraqi troops?
There are some advisors on the front lines, around the front lines, advising the Iraqi troops, and they're there to help call in airstrikes and to call them in quicker. There's also a U.S. base not far from Mosul, which is directing their fighter jets and drones over the city and calling in airstrikes from there.
But they're not picking up weapons and shooting?
Officially, no.
Now, what makes the battle for the west of Mosul so different from the east?
The way that the West is different to the East is it's so densely packed. If you've seen pictures of these of Western Mosul, it's just the narrow alleyways and narrow streets and just lots of people packed into a very small area. So whereas in Eastern Mosul, where they would take it block by block, in here they're having to fight house by house. And ISIS has been very good at drilling holes through houses and making tunnels and just making it as difficult as possible for advancing Iraqi forces.
Have you noticed changes in the U.S. position or strategy in Mosul since President Trump entered the White House?
It's interesting. There hasn't really been a huge change. There was some speculation when Trump first came to power because there was a huge uptick of civilian casualties caused by U.S. airstrikes. But the U.S. military, the Pentagon, has come out in the past couple of weeks, and said that there have been no changes to the rules of engagement. But despite that, civilians still are dying at the hands of U.S. airstrikes in the city because it's so densely populated and because so many people are packed into such a small area.
And who are these people who are stuck in western Mosul? Who are they among the kind of ethnic and social fabric of Iraq? And what are their loyalties?
They will be largely Sunni residents of Mosul. Now, that doesn't mean they're supporters of ISIS. From people we've spoken to who have managed to escape Mosul after all this time, many of them just couldn't afford to leave the city. They didn't have the means. And others were just too scared to try. I mean, lots of people have died trying to escape Mosul. And especially now, it's just way too dangerous for anyone to try and think about escaping. So the people in the city now, they'll be bunkering down in their houses, just hoping and praying that they don't get hit by an airstrike and hoping that they don't get used as a human shield by ISIS.
Rich, is there one image that really sticks with you?
There is actually, I was visiting a hospital south of Mosul, quite away from the fighting, actually. It was in a village that had been cleared months earlier by Iraqi forces. And in the hospital there were two boys who had been killed. They were brought in, their bodies were brought in. They'd been killed by explosives left behind by ISIS fighters in a field near a playground where children play. And this is actually happening all over Iraq in areas that have been cleared of ISIS. Deadly explosives left behind, some on purpose, some just grenades that have been left around. And this will actually be a huge challenge in Western Mosul and Mosul in general. Just the sheer amount of explosives and bombs that have been dropped on the city will just make making the city safe extremely difficult.
The world's Rich Hall, just back from northern Iraq, observing the battle for Mosul. Thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you.
Residents of coastal Newfoundland, Canada, have a pretty amazing view out their windows. The blue North Atlantic Ocean fills most of the frame. But the other day, some massive, and I do mean massive, objects floated into view. Icebergs. We called up the mayor of Fairyland, Newfoundland. The mayor's name is Adrian Kavanaugh. Mayor Kavanaugh, you've already been out for a stroll this morning along the shore. What did you see?
Well, the iceberg was there and everybody was taking photographs there. It was on just the left-hand side of the island. It's just off the coast. And people are still coming now and take pictures of it. And it's been the same here. Almost every year, sometimes you'd have, you know, lots of ice and icebergs. So other years, you might get the odd one, but you know, it all depends on the weather and the wind direction.
How big is this iceberg?
Well, it's hard to say, but you get to say three houses together in a row. That shows you about what the size of it is, right?
And, of course, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, they're down below. There's probably eight or nine times that, down below, right?
Have you lived in Fairyland your whole life?
Yeah, pretty well, yeah.
Is this pretty typical that these kind of big icebergs kind of float into view every spring?
Well, this time of the year, like, you get all the ice coming down from Greenland. It comes down along the coast of Newfoundland and usually then it veers off into the Gulf Stream and takes it offshore from there, but if you get the northerly winds, northeast winds, you get the same ice and same icebergs. It'll come up around the point and it'll come up along the southern shore.
So this iceberg will eventually float away and break down and melt somewhere, or does it just kind of float back up to the Arctic? Where does it go?
No, it just floats. It floats off then into the Gulf Stream, and eventually it'll crack up and flounder and just be small pieces.
On the icebergs, do you see any seabirds or wildlife?
Not on this one here, this particular one, but a lot of the ice that come down there, sometimes you see seals. And I don't know how many years ago now, but when the pack ice came down, a polar bear came in on the pack ice, came into the community itself.
Ooh.
That happened in several communities along the coast of Newfoundland this winter. That the polar bears came ashore and they take them, the wildlife will tranquilize, take them and bring them up north so they can head back to their to their home or whatever.
A lot of tourists there are taking pictures of this big iceberg. What are the kind of colors and contrasts are in those pictures?
Depending on the time of day and the sunshine on it. And there's a few pictures there where they were taken in the evening and that with the moon over top of the iceberg. And there's some really nice photographs. And also, like, with the community in the background and things like that, it's a photographer's delight to see something like this, I guess.
Adrian Kavanaugh is the mayor of Fairyland, a town in the province of Newfoundland, Labrador in Canada. Thanks a lot.
All right. Drop down here sometime. You might get to see one yourself.
Or you can head over to our website. You can see pictures of those giant icebergs off the coast of Newfoundland at PRI.org. How one group of Jewish prisoners dug a tunnel to survive the Holocaust. That story's just ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. More than 70 years ago, in the waning days of the Holocaust, a group of Jewish prisoners dug a tunnel using their bare hands and spoons. Then, on the last night of Passover, 1944, they crawled under the feet of their Nazi captors to freedom. A team of archaeologists has now discovered the tunnel in the Ponar Forest, outside of Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. A new Nova documentary about the discovery airs tonight on PBS. Nova's Paula Apsel says that until just recently, no one knew if the escape tunnel really existed.
The children of these prisoners who escaped from Ponar had told stories about it. But the tunnel itself had never been found. The entrance had, but nothing else. So no one knew if the tunnel had been completed.
Paula, what happened in Ponar Forest? What was this site?
Well, Ponar Forest started out as an oil and gas depot. When the Russians ran Lithuania, they dug these pits as a place to store oil and gas. Then in 1941, when the Nazis moved in and started to instigate the Final Solution to wipe out European Jewry, they thought, oh, well, how convenient. Look, we have all these pits and we can just toss the Jewish bodies in there. So Ponar became an amazing killing field. And it was a place where the so-called Holocaust of bullets started. Not a lot of people knew, and I did not know when I started this film, that half of the victims of the Holocaust were shot one by one, not killed in the gas chambers. That actually came later. So the Germans got the Lithuanians, a certain rifle reorganization, to do the killing for them under their direction. 70,000 Jews were shot one by one and thrown into these pits.
And where does the tunnel come into this story about Pinar Forest?
Well, from 1941 to 1943, the Nazis succeeded in killing almost all the Jews of Vilna or Vilnius. And then they knew that the Russians were coming. The Russians were on the border. And they decided they had to hide the evidence of these atrocities, of their war crimes. So they found 80 Jewish prisoners somewhere around who hadn't yet been brought to Ponar. And they brought them to the forest not to be shot, but to work. There were 4 women, 76 men. They lived there for several months. And their job was to dig up and to burn the remaining bodies. Well, as the number of bodies dwindled, they realized that when their job was over, they would be next. So they hatched a plan, and they decided that they would dig a tunnel and try to escape. So they all worked on this tunnel, and it was from the pit where they lived out to the edge of the forest where they believed that the partisans were waiting. They dug the tunnel, and 12 of them actually succeeded in escaping. The minute they made noise, the Germans started shooting, and many of them were shot, most of them. But 12 actually escaped. 11 survived and made it to the end of the war, where they went to the United States eventually, to Israel, and to Russia.
There's just a sort of unbearably moving anecdote in the film about one of the Jewish prisoners who was made to pull these bodies together and burn them. And if you could recount it for us.
Yeah, so this was Dr. Chaim Matzkin's father. And he had been married and had children. And when he was exhuming the bodies and preparing them to be burned, putting them on the pyre, he found his wife and also 2 of his children. And I think that was actually a common experience for the prisoners, that they recognized people they knew, some of them very close relatives, some of them wives and children. And it is just unimaginable how they managed to do this and still retain the spirit that propelled them to take this enormous risk and dig this tunnel and want to preserve their lives.
It's an amazing story. What led archaeologists to go to find this tunnel? Why weren't verbal accounts of various descendants enough?
Verbal accounts are very important. And the descendants had been telling these stories, but a lot of people didn't really believe them. And as you know from the Holocaust deniers, the verbal accounts mean nothing to them. They say that people don't remember it correctly, that they're exaggerating it. The Lithuanian archaeologists had themselves looked for the tunnel, and they were able to find the entrance to the tunnel, but they couldn't find any continuation of the tunnel. So they were saying that perhaps it was never finished. No one really knew. And so when the archaeologists, using ground-penetrating radar and another technology called electrical resistivity tomography, when they actually found the tunnel, here it is, concrete proof that the tunnel actually did exist.
Why couldn't the archaeologists just dig for it? What made the technology necessary?
First of all, you cannot dig in a mass grave because you cannot bring on a second insult to the people who are buried there. There are people, there are bodies all over Ponar. So you must use non-invasive techniques. And that was why they brought this technology. Now, this is a technology that's actually used in the oil and gas industry. And the technology itself, the machinery, is so expensive that there's no way that any archaeologist could afford it. So it is loaned to our archaeologists by a company in Canada. And that's how they were able to use it.
How did the children of the survivors react when the archaeologists told them what they'd found?
When we found the tunnel, when our archaeological team found the tunnel, it made news all over the world. And the children of the survivors actually reached out to us. They are fantastic people. They have been living with these stories all of their lives. Their fathers in Israel used to meet every night on the last night of Passover. They would get together every year in order to recount this. And it really marked their lives. One of the survivors, Hana Amir, told me that her father used to wash his hands and wash his hands and wash his hands. And she has three sons. And when the children were little, he kept washing their hands until she finally said, "Daddy, you can't do this anymore." They were not at Ponar. And so they lived with the terrible memories of how horrible it must have been. And yet they had the stories. Of course they believed the stories, but they needed the closure. And now they have actual concrete scientific evidence and proof that these stories are true.
Paula Apsel is NOVA's senior executive producer. She co-directed the documentary Holocaust Escape Tunnel, which airs tonight on PBS. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, the Cominas. They're punk rockers from Boston who love to turn it up to 11 and challenge cultural assumptions and stereotypes.
With three Pakistanis and one Indian, this band will never play in either Pakistan or India. We've been invited to festivals in India before. Some of the top ones are like, nope.
Cranking it up with the Cominas. That story and much more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. An American who went missing in Mexico last week has been found, injured, but alive. His name is Hugo Castro, and he's now recovering in a Mexico City hospital. Castro is an activist with the migrant relief group Border Angels. He was traveling for them just outside Mexico City last Thursday when he noticed he was being followed and feared for his life. So he went live on Facebook.
Seriously, I was threatened. They want to kill me.
¿Me quieren matar?
That clip is taken from a story by Gene Guerrero, who's covering the story for KPBS in Castro's hometown of San Diego. Gene, how bad are Hugo Castro's injuries?
So right now, his family isn't releasing a lot of information. The attorney general has told them not to answer questions from the media right now. However, his partner, Gaba Cortes, has been posting on Facebook, and she says he's in a very delicate physical condition, that the medical prognosis is, quote unquote, guarded. I'm not exactly sure what that means. They are saying that he will survive. But it appears that he was beaten up pretty badly with wounds all over his body.
What do we know for sure about what happened to him?
So we don't know much at this point. All we know is that after he posted the Facebook Live video begging for help, saying that he was being followed and feared for his life, that he simply disappeared and nobody was able to get a hold of him. The attorney general is saying that they've launched an investigation into what they call the illegal deprivation of freedom of Castro. This suggests that they have some evidence that he was, in fact, kidnapped or held against his will at some point during the period in which he was missing. But they're not releasing any additional details at this time.
Now, I know Hugo Castro, as we mentioned, he's an activist with the group Border Angels. Is anyone suggesting a motive for the apparent kidnapping?
Yes. So many people close to him say that he'd received multiple death threats in the past, precisely because of his advocacy work. He'd been leading this program called SOS Migrant Adopt a Shelter, which I'd actually spent an entire day with him just a few weeks before he disappeared, covering this work that he does, where he brings food and other essentials to migrants who are stuck in Tijuana on their way to the U.S. or who were hoping to get into the U.S. and no longer can, for example. There are currently hundreds of Haitians who are stuck in Tijuana after some immigration rule changes, so they can no longer go into the U.S. And he's been providing them with advice on how to avoid being exploited, kidnapped. One thing that a lot of people don't realize, I think, in the U.S. is that migrants are a group that is it's probably the number one targeted group by drug cartels. They're such a vulnerable population that the cartels regularly profit off of kidnapping them, human trafficking, exploiting them in other ways. And so people were angry and had threatened Castro's life in the past, saying, "You're interfering with our work and we're going to kill you." We don't know if these threats that he'd received in the past were in fact related to his disappearance, but that is what a lot of people close to him have suggested.
Tell me a little bit more about Border Angels, this group he's a part of. What is their job? To protect migrants, to help migrants cross? What do they actually do?
Right. So they're an advocacy group for immigrants. They have programs like SOS Migrant to provide help to the migrant shelters in Tijuana. They're very low on resources. They don't have a lot of help from the Mexican federal government. So Border Angels has taken it upon itself to help those shelters. They also go out and they leave water in the desert for migrants in danger of dehydration. I spoke to Enrique Morones, the founder, about the group and what it does and how he thinks it's related to what happened to Castro.
There's people that don't appreciate you taking away their livelihood. It could be people that are involved in trafficking. It could be organized crime. We don't know.
You met Hugo Castro just a few weeks ago. What's he like?
So he's a big personality. I mean, he's very outspoken. And this was another thing that people were saying, that he's not afraid of telling authorities, criminals, when he thinks that they're doing something wrong. In fact, in my story, he confronts the director of a migrant shelter who had just kicked out a bunch of the Haitian migrants and said they could no longer stay there. And he confronted him on camera saying, "How could you do this? This is so messed up." And so he's very outspoken. He really cares about migrant issues and wasn't afraid to speak up.
Jean Guerrero of KPBS in San Diego, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Our next story also features someone who helps migrants on their way through Mexico. It's also a story about a place just across Mexico's southern border with Guatemala, where some migrants know they'll be welcomed for a change. Amy Bracken takes it from there.
I'm getting a tour of a bare-bones hotel in the small border city of Tapachula. The manager is petite, 59 years old. She wears pink glasses and gold-colored teddy bear earrings.
Me llamo Concepción González Ramírez.
Concepción González Ramírez. She's from Mexico, but is known as Mama Africa.
Me dicen Mama Africa.
She's called that because the hotel, actually she, has become a destination for Africans and Haitians passing through. The hotel isn't that charming. Guests pay just $2.50 a night, and the walls are peeling and the room's basic, metal beds, plain furniture. In the lobby, there's a parrot in a cage. There's no sign for the hotel either, but still, African and Haitian migrants by the hundreds have found their way here.
Mucha gente me decía.
She says, "I'm told people up the road start yelling out, 'Mama Africa, where's Mama Africa?'" There's a lull now, but earlier this year, Ramirez had 200 guests at a time. There are only 24 rooms, so some people slept on cardboard outside. She doesn't want to turn anyone away. And she helps out by taking sick guests to the hospital, buying medicine they can't afford, rubbing balm on travel-weary feet. Chichik Sebastiao arrived recently. He's from Angola. I ask him if Mama Africa is a fitting nickname for Ramirez.
Oui, oui.
Yes, yes, he says. I feel she is really like that, because African women are very nice women, very loving. We're really comfortable here, he says. He had already been living in Brazil, but for some Africans, a popular route to the U.S. is to first fly to South America and then head north. I also speak with Félix Michelet from Haiti. Like a lot of Haitians, he lived in Brazil, working construction ahead of the Olympics and the World Cup. When Brazil's economy weakened, he began making his way to the U.S. Michelet has been at Mama Africa's for several months, selling SIM cards to make enough money for the bus to Tijuana. I ask if he'll stay in touch with Ramirez.
Mama Africa is mama, no, no, pas jamais la gueule.
He says Mama Africa is our mom. We're never going to let her go.
Y mucha gente que me manda WhatsApp.
Ramirez says former guests often text her, saying hello or reporting progress on their trip. She says her work is motivated by her Christian faith. She also says she doesn't know much about Africa, though she learned from guests how to make Ghanaian-style chicken. Ramirez might be famous around here, but she's not the only beacon for migrants in Tapachula. Across town, a dirt road dead-ends at Jesus Valenzuela's house.
Bonjour, hola.
This winter, Valenzuela and his family made space in their small home for guests. Valenzuela, a local cop, saw that Africans especially were being overcharged for bus tickets. He started helping them get a fair deal and offered up his home for a buck a night. Now up to 25 people stay here at a time, mostly Haitians. Valenzuela says he knows what his guests go through. I was in the United States. I've experienced what they're experiencing, he says. There are places where people help and places where they don't. So that's why I wanted to support and help them. Back at Mama Africa's, Ramirez shows me photos of guests who've touched her life. There's a picture of her daughter with hair cornrowed by a guest. She laughs but seems nostalgic. They've left, she says. They've left. For the world, Amy Bracken, Tapachula, Mexico.
There's a lot of soul-searching going on in Pakistan right now. It follows the death by lynching of a student at a university in northern Pakistan. The country's parliament has condemned the killing as barbaric. The student's name was Mashal Khan. He was known for his liberal views on religion and society. The mob that killed him reportedly included fellow students, possibly also teachers, who accused him of blasphemy. And I should warn you, some of the details are hard to listen to. Sukunder Karmani has been covering the case. He's in Islamabad. Sukunder, what do we know about why Mashal was murdered?
Well, Mashal was quite open in his views to an extent. He described himself on Facebook as a humanist. He believed in a kind of secular liberal philosophy. Inside his room, there were posters of Che Guevara and Karl Marx, for example. And I was speaking to a friend of Mashal Khan's, and he was telling me that Mashal had been threatened by other students before, and that Mashal knew that he faced a degree of hostility from other students who had a more socially conservative and a more Islamist outlook. One of the students accused of being part of the lynch mob that killed him has confessed his role to police, and parts of that confession have been leaked to the media. I've seen it. And this suspect describes how he has long accused Mashal Khan of being someone who has blasphemous views on religion and on Islam, and therefore someone who needed to be tackled in some format. Why exactly things escalated so much on Thursday and of last week, and why exactly the mob decided to target him then, is still not clear.
It's a grisly story, but can you tell us how he was killed?
Yes, it's really horrific, partly because much of the assault was captured by onlookers on mobile phone footage. So you see Mashal Khan being beaten to death by a crowd of, must be a couple of hundred men, with sticks, with their fists, stamping on him. It seems that Mashal Khan was aware that the mob was looking for him. He was hiding in his hostel room. The mob, though, found him. They broke into the hostel. They kicked the door down. They kicked the door into his room down and started beating him. Post-mortem results also showed that he was shot, but even long after he was dead, the mob still continued to beat his body to a real pulp in really, really graphic, violent scenes that have been shared right across Pakistan. One witness who was there told me that the mob wanted to try and set Mashal Khan's body alight and burn it. Even after having killed him, the police at that stage managed to retrieve the body. Police were on the scene, and there has been some criticism for them for not doing more to try and prevent this attack. They said that the numbers were too large for them to have done anything, and they did what they could.
What is the setting for this? It sounds just horrific. It also is kind of reminiscent of things that are going on in Bangladesh in terms of people with secular views of any sort being attacked and often murdered. But what is this blasphemous laws that are being invoked in this case that apparently set people to murder this student?
Sure. Blasphemy is actually legally punishable by death in Pakistan. Although the state has never actually carried out that penalty, a number of people have been given the death sentence, but they've never actually been executed by the state. But a significant number of people who have been accused of blasphemy, either legally or just by rumors, so to speak, have been lynched or murdered. There's been a lot of criticism here in Pakistan of the role of the state, because in recent weeks, the prime minister and the authorities here have talked a lot about blasphemy. They talked about potentially, for example, banning all social media in order to stop blasphemous content online being shared within Pakistan. So there's been some criticism by liberal commentators saying that the mood setting for this was set by the authorities, although the authorities, after a few days, came out and did condemn this awful murder.
Finally, what are the chances that Mashal Khan's killers will face justice?
Well, at the moment, there's a huge level of political pressure on this case, and there's a huge amount of public opinion really demanding that action be taken. And that feeling comes from across the political spectrum, irrespective of whether you're liberal or whether you're from the religious right wing. So I think that will go some way. Having said that, the justice system in Pakistan is ridden with problems. People who have the right connections are often able to escape punishment. Cases often drag on for many years. So, and there's such a huge number of people involved in this incident. On the other side, lots of the people who are involved, there's quite clear evidence of their involvement because it's all filmed on mobile phone footage that's been widely seen by not just the police, but by the whole of Pakistan, who will, and certainly at the moment, do seem to be demanding strict punishment for those behind this murder.
The BBC's Pakistan correspondent, Sukhinder Kermani, speaking to us from Islamabad. Thanks, Sukhinder.
Thanks.
Hecklers are the worst, right? Like when somebody stands next to you at a concert and starts yelling dumb things at the stage. We've all witnessed that. But what if you're the artist and that heckler isn't making fun of your music, but of your skin color or religion? The World's Rupa Shenoy sat down with the members of one band who've had that experience.
So who wants to start by telling me what happened?
Kornos.
You saw it?
Yeah, I saw it. It was incredibly distracting.
Wait, put me in the place.
So we were in the middle of our set. This kid standing really close to the stage just holds his two middle fingers up in the air and just starts yelling America.
It was a sold out show. There's literally like 500 white people behind this person. Nobody steps in to like do anything or like tell anyone.
He hits somebody. So yeah, at that point, the guy did get thrown out.
It does suck that this happened to us, but it also sucks that people tolerated that. And it had to get to a point of like this guy being aggressive towards women for him to get kicked out. Because it's kind of like, you know, if somebody's being racist, like chances are they're like sexist.
Yeah, they check off all the boxes.
Yeah. So it's like initially,
you don't go light on hatred. You go all or nothing.
Right. But overall, like the crowd was very much like into us. That's partly why I probably didn't even notice this guy because I was like just shredding and like killing it.
You know? Shredding so hard.
Yeah. Okay, let's pause for a second for some background. You should know who these guys are.
I'm Shah Jahan.
Guitarist Shah Jahan Khan.
I'm Basim.
Bassist and singer Basim Usmani.
I'm Sunny Ali.
Guitarist and singer Sunny Ali.
I'm Korno.
And drummer Korno Ray. Together, they're the Kominas, which is Urdu for scoundrel. For a dozen years, they've put out albums that combine punk with comedy and commentary on American and Muslim culture. Devoted fans across the world also love the Kominas' music videos, like the 2015 video to this song, See Something, Say Something. It shows a white guy on a train imagining the brown people around him as religious fanatics with fangs or terrorists carrying bombs and wearing gas masks. I can't do it justice here, but take my word for it. It's funny.
If you see something, you better say something. Nothing at all, nothing at all.
With material like that, the Kominas are used to getting flack. So what happened at the concert in Cambridge, Massachusetts in early April, the kid with two middle fingers up yelling America, that wasn't surprising to them.
Should we even be making a thing of this? Does that take away from the good stuff that happened that night?
Yeah. Something that I'm coming to digest over the last couple of days is that we're a brown band that speaks on identity, but the amount of attention that we glean from one white guy doing something at our shows, all of a sudden everybody comes out of the woodwork, like, describe his behavior. We want to know what exactly he did at your show where you put together a set where you're talking about your issues, you're playing your music, you're drawing from your influences. Yeah. What did that guy do?
Oh, yeah.
So meanwhile, that guy was a plant for you to get more publicity.
Exactly.
Yeah, actually, I hired him. Yeah.
Definitely hired him. It wasn't like we immediately took to social media. We took like 8 hours because overall, like, it was a great show. The venue, their response was really great, too. But at the same time, like, they might never book us again just to be safe. Like,
squeaky nail gets the hammer.
Yeah, you know? So that's something that we have to talk about before we bring this stuff up. Like, is it worth, like, not getting booked?
So I was reading a lot of stories about you guys, and no one asked you about your families. And I was thinking about it because if you were brown girls, as a brown girl myself, I'd be like, what do your families think? Because they'd probably be really scared for your safety or something like that.
Totally. Yeah.
My mom actually sent sort of a supportive text message just yesterday being like, Beta, don't let these negative people bother you.
They've pretty much just given up on us, I think, and have no choice. But, you know, I never went to college, and now it's nice to be like, hey, Mom, we might play at Harvard. And she's like, take a picture in front of
take
the Harvard
sign. Take a diploma home with you.
Did like, she really say that?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
People really don't ask us about our families.
That's a really good
about
point.
That question, because it's like we're friends with many artists. They're brown girls. And it's just interesting because they all had to go to college, had to be successful people, and they're all like killing it in their fields. But, you know, the music thing was seen as a hobby, you know, and it's not seen as a hobby for me because I'm a boy. Like, that's like a part of that, you know.
And you get to criticize religion and criticize culture.
It's a spillover effect for all of that stuff.
Yeah, I also had an older sister who she taught me like a riff on the piano because she would take piano lessons, and that was the first time I was like, oh, like this is cool. And then she took the brunt of the parenting. She was the eldest and also a woman, so she had like an arranged marriage.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up right outside of Philly.
There's a big temple there, Hindu temple. You're the Hindu, right?
I'm the Hindu token.
So do you, are you like the Hindu-Muslim unity?
We represent world peace wherever we go. We bind cultures together.
Deepak Chopra comes in.
Class, color, gender, or any other category.
A new paradigm
we are
shift
the glue
in consciousness.
Of the universe keeping it all together, and I'm the cap on the glue. I'm the token non-Muslim, non-Pakistani, which means I'm Hindu and Indian. So my mom has, for the last 10 years, been wondering why I would publicly put myself into a more dangerous position than I'd otherwise be in. And there's a funny anecdote, too.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. We did a show on BuzzFeed called See Something, Say Something.
Yeah.
I thought my mom would be proud that we were playing at the Green Space, so I gave her, like, the link. And so she's watching, and the host, Amit Ali Akbar, he says, we need to be able to say Allahu Akbar in public. So he invoked everybody to say Allahu Akbar on stage. And as soon as my mom, like, I don't know if
she
the camera was
in.
Focused in on my face or something saying it. But, like, as soon as that happened, my mom just started sending me these frantic text messages. It's like, don't ever forget that you're Hindu.
I am an Islamist. I am the Antichrist. Most squares that make most wanted lists. But mama, how I stay inside.
What do they think of you in Pakistan?
I think we're freaks. Don't like us.
I mean, we don't necessarily fit in there.
It's kind of a running joke that with three Pakistanis and one Indian, this band will never play in either Pakistan or India. We've been invited to festivals in India before. Some of the top ones are like, nope, pretty much aren't going to let you in because of the Pakistan thing.
Same thing in Pakistan. People are like, nope, it's going to be too hard to do that.
Yeah.
So in a weird way, you guys are like super American.
Oh, dude, we're more American than white people.
We're an American band.
American band.
We're an American band.
We end with Grand Funk Railroad, but those were the Comminas speaking with the world's Roopa Shenoy. She hosts our Otherhood podcast. Find it on iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcasts. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.